Hello, welcome back to the Christian Leaders Institute, History 101. My name is Rich Hamstra, and it's been my pleasure to be the instructor for this class.
I was trying to figure out why are you so dark and all that, and then these lights are on.
Aha.
That'll do
it. So we'll start over.
Yeah.
Give me time to get another sip of coffee.
Yeah. Everybody wants to know what you put in that coffee that you're so
Hello, welcome back to the Christian Leaders Institute, History 101, the beginnings of civilization until the year 1500. My name is Rich Hamstra, and it's been my pleasure to be the instructor for this class. This is the final session in this class, and afterwards you'll find questions on the last third of the course. We have been looking at various cultures in this class around the world throughout this time period. But in this final section, we're going to really focus on Western Europe. And in particular, we're going to focus on Italy and some of the huge changes that come about out of Italy during this period of time. That's, of course, in Rome. And there was a period of time that the Pope and the papal power was actually in France, as we discussed earlier in the course. But fundamentally, the power of the church is extraordinarily significant. And we're just picking up a little bit where we left off in the last section, just to remind ourselves of how important the church is in medieval Europe. It is the one universal. There are various nations and there are principalities and powers and kings and all sorts of intrigues and empires and the like. But throughout all of Europe, it's just one church. And while there's often huge differences between, particularly north of the Alps and south of the Alps, so, for instance, the way Christianity is lived out and practiced in Ireland and England, in the Scandinavian countries, in Germany and France, is different at this time from how it's lived out in Italy, Sicily, Spain. But still one church under basically the Pope. Notice that the church is the largest landowner, and that meant that they were able to reap the harvest of those lands. Much of the church's wealth comes from the people who worked those lands, and then the profits went back to the church. The monasteries, the abbots, the nunneries were all very lucrative places, as well as places of education and often places where they cared for the sick. The church has control of the minds of the people and really of the intellectual life of Western Europe. For the most part, the church said, this is what truth is. This is what reality is. And this is what we study. This is what we believe. And this is how we are saved. And the church retained exclusive control over the means of salvation, particularly through the various sacraments that the church practice at this time. So outside the church, there literally was no hope of salvation. So it's also the period of time during the medieval time that the great Gothic cathedrals are built in Cologne, in England, Germany, France. These great humongous churches and humongous cathedrals that are built often over the period of centuries of time, again, using the wealth of Europe. Probably one of the most significant individuals, who's not a pope, but one of the leaders of the medieval time, is the theologian Thomas Aquinas. And I just merely copied this out of a Wikipedia article on Thomas Aquinas, but I thought it well summarized and introduced him to us, and then I'll add a few things. St. Thomas Aquinas, born around 1225 and died on March 7, 1274, so less than 50 years old when he died, was an Italian Dominican friar, a Catholic priest, and doctor of the Church. He was an immensely influential philosopher, theologian, and jurist in the tradition of Scholasticism. Now, Scholasticism is a movement in the 13th century within the Catholic Church in which they worked very hard at wedding together both biblical teaching, what we know by faith, and what we understand by observation, what we see in the world around us and by deduction from that. So it's a wedding of faith and reason together, and huge volumes are written at this period of time. Aquinas' works are voluminous, to say the least, in which there is argument and counter-argument given for different propositions about whether or not they're true. So that is a little bit about Scholasticism, and within which he is known as the Doctor Angelicus and the Doctor Communicus. That is, he is the heavenly doctor, the angelic doctor, and the doctor of the community. He was a foremost classical proponent of natural theology. We'll say a little bit more on that later, and the father of Thomism, of which he argued that reason is found in God. So there's no conflict between faith and reason, but while they're not the same, reason is a gift of God. Thomas' influence on Western thought is considerable, and much of modern philosophy developed or opposed his ideas, certainly true, particularly in the areas of ethics, natural law, metaphysics, and political theory. Unlike many currents in the church of the time, Thomas embraced several ideas put forward by Aristotle, whom he called the philosopher, and attempted to synthesize the real Aristotelian philosophy with the principles of Christianity. And this is one of the main reasons that we should remember who he is. So, during the period of the Crusades, the Crusaders are exposed through the Arabs, who kept alive, actually, Aristotle, exposed to Greek philosophers, particularly Aristotle, and he's also known in Byzantium, but it's primarily through Islamic scholarship that Crusaders learn about Aristotle. They bring him back, and Thomas and others pick up on the principles of Aristotle. Now, Aristotelian, in brief, his philosophy is in contrast to Plato, who thought about the world and that this world was not actually true. The real world for Plato existed on an ideal plane, and all we actually knew here were shadows of what was true. In contrast to that, Aristotle understood that the material world had some real truth in it and was not ephemeral, was not devious. And if by observation you could make deductions on how things worked, his is very much a natural kind of philosophy, or as natural as it could be in Aristotle's time. And so Thomas takes Aristotle's understanding of the world as the place that you can apprehend what is true by observation, by looking and then making deductions, making theories about that. He takes that and applies it to his own day and applies it to Catholic doctrine, Catholic teachings. His best known works are the Disputed Questions on Truth, the Summa Theologica, and the Summa Contra Gentiles. And this, the two books are called Summa, just means the great or the height of, or the compilation of those teachings. The Catholic Church honors Thomas Aquinas as a saint and regards him as a model teacher for those studying for the priesthood. That's true. He's often just referred to as the doctor, as the teacher. And indeed, the highest expression of both natural reason and speculative theology. So prior to this time of the Scholastics, it's really St. Augustine who, at the end of the 4th century, beginning of the 5th century, sets Catholic doctrine in significant ways. And the Church is basically Augustinian in most of its teaching throughout the Middle Ages. Augustine is much more of a Platonist or a Neoplatonist, follows the sort of Plato sort of way to look at the world. Aristotle influenced Thomas, and there's a huge shift in how the Catholic Church understands what theology is and how to do theology when it comes to Thomas. So for Augustine, we'll just use a central dispute point until today in the Christian world. What does it mean when we celebrate the Mass, the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, the Last Supper, when we celebrate that sacrament and we say, in the words of Christ, "This is my body." This has both united, as communion is supposed to do, but also divided Christians. In many ways, the Reformation has been described as a dispute over what these words mean. "This is my body." Well, St. Augustine took Jesus to mean this in a much more figurative way, to have a spiritual meaning. And this is a quote from Augustine, from one of his sermons. "What you see on God's altar, you've already observed during the night that has now ended. But you've heard nothing about just what it might be, or what it might mean, or what great thing it might be said to symbolize." Now, that word "symbolize" is awfully important here. It means that one thing stands for another. "For what you see is simply bread and a cup. This is the information your eyes report. But your faith demands far subtler insight." So for Augustine, it is our faith by which we understand that this indeed is Jesus' body, Jesus' blood, that we are participating in as Christians when we celebrate communion. It is by faith. "But your faith demands a far subtler insight. The bread is Christ's body, the cup is Christ's blood." End of quote. So that is how Augustine, in brief, would talk about the Lord's Supper. And in their own way, Protestants all accept that understanding. I mean, one way to understand the difference between Protestants and Catholics is mostly to say, Protestants are much more Augustinian, and Catholics are much more Thomist, that is, Thomas Aquinas, in many, many ways. Especially when it comes to this question of what does it mean when we say, "This is my body." The Church, the Catholic Church throughout the Middle Ages and up until today, has held to a doctrine called transubstantiation. And in this doctrine, during a certain sacred moment, the wafer and the wine literally transubstantiate. They change reality into the body and blood of Christ. So it is understood as a metaphysical change in some respects into the actual body and blood of Christ. Now, of course, one can look at those elements and say, well, but they still look the same, they still act the same. And for generations, hundreds of years, actually, the Catholic Church thought about how it could explain this and how it could understand it. And it really came to Aquinas, rather, when he wedded together Aristotle and how to reason and faith. And he, Thomas Aquinas, we won't go into any detail on this, but Thomas Aquinas then spent a lot of ink and a lot of pages presenting logical arguments to prove that transubstantiation was true, and it still remains today the official doctrine of the Church. So that becomes a real dividing point later on when the Reformation comes between Protestants and Catholics. Protestants, for the most part, will not accept or do not accept what St. Thomas said about this is my body. There's another huge topic that Aquinas spent all sorts of time on, and that is the question of natural law. And it really kind of boils down a little bit to the question of whether or not we, if we accept what the Scripture says is true, can we also accept that there's truth through observation in the world around us? And in much of the Middle Ages, there was a rejection of that. In much of the Middle Ages, it was the only truth that we can know is by Scripture. And what we see with our eyes, the world around us, what we can discover by science, and they didn't even use that word, but what we can discover by investigation of the world around it is not to be trusted. And that's one reason why there is insistence. For instance, the Bible talks about the four corners of the earth. The Church insisted the world is square, had edges, and if you sailed too far, you would fall off the edge. There were scientists who said, no, it's round. Faith and reason were at in conflict during the Middle Ages already, and faith was understood as the only way to apprehend truth. So one of the things that Thomas did when he took over Aristotle was to say, no, there is truth. We can understand what is real, what is accurate, what is factual, what is true by reason as well as by faith. In fact, you don't have to have faith. The non-Christians, whom they refer to in the during the Middle Ages as the infidel can know truth through this natural law just as well as a believer. Now, this was pretty scandalous in Thomas' days, and he had many, many people who argued against him, but that's one of the reasons he writes as much as he does, and as long as he does. So he ruled that all people will be able to grasp by using reason, whether they believe in the Bible or not. He also argued that natural laws, the things that we can learn from nature, are binding on everyone. So there's sort of a universal ethic, not just a Christian ethic, not just a Christian morality, but there's a universal morality that applies to everyone. And that universal morality we learn from nature. we learn those from what they, what he talked about as the common human inclinations. And he cites three in particular. These are for him sort of the prime directives of what it means to be human and the prime directives of his natural law. The first one is self-preservation. The second one is reproduction. And the third is the use of reason to order our lives, in other words, to organize things, to decide which things to do first, which things to not to do, and the like. To order our lives. The use of reason is true for everyone, whether one's a believer or not. The urge, the inclination for self-preservation is the number one directive for everyone, Christian or not. The urge to reproduce, everyone, Christian or not. And he builds a huge ethical system based upon these three basic principles that he says applies to everybody. And they are fundamentally, after some development, of course, and argument, they become really the basis of Catholic doctrine and Catholic ethics right until this day. You'll see those things reflected, for instance, even in today's position, the Catholic Church position on birth control. Common human inclination to reproduce, they say, cannot be in any way, shape, or form, be artificially interfered with. That violates natural law. They don't argue that from a Christian perspective, but from a common human perspective. So it's true not just for Christians, it ought to be true for everybody. There ought to be no means of artificial birth control. They argue that with respect to abortion, that's grounded both in self-preservation as well as reproduction. That entity, that child, is understood to be have fully formed rights and individuality as soon as the conception happens, based on natural law. They will argue. They argue that on euthanasia, that the principle of self-preservation will not allow in any cases or any moments for the use of euthanasia. And those are just illustrations of the way Thomas theology and Thomistic theology, Aquinas' theology, still applies today for the vast majority of those who are Christians in our world. So Thomas Aquinas brings scholasticism into the medieval times, and particularly into medieval thinking, intellectual thinking in the 13th century. The medieval age is, intellectually at least, or in their thought, is, I think, characterized rightfully by talking about it as theocentric. God is the first reality that they think of. Everything is about their relationship to God, or at least what God has done, what God thinks, who God is, whether God exists. There are endless discussions and proofs for the existence of God and the like by different theologians and philosophers. But always a starting point of all thought during the Middle Ages is, who is God? There comes a pretty radical change, and it is a change that is still going on in a lot of ways in modern societies in the 14th century. And it gets a huge start in what is called the Renaissance. Now, that again is sort of a made-up term to describe a period of time and a number of different thinkers and movements that happen in late 13th century, mid 14th century, and carrying on into often the 16th century, and I would argue in many respects is still developing today. And that is the shift from the starting point of really all artistic intellectual pursuits as being theology, who is God, to anthropology, who is human. The shift, it does not mean that because one includes the anthropological question, who is human, that one excludes the theological, but it is about where does one start? What is the center of one's inquiry, one's thought, one's art, one's wondering? This is the fundamental shift that I think begins here in the Renaissance. And I would ask you, or actually assign to you, the reading and the Wikipedia article on the Renaissance. So the 14th century saw an intellectual and cultural change. And again, it's slow and it's not universal and it spreads and it's different in different places. But it's still perceivable as a great shift in the history of the Western world, for sure, that applied the classical Greek and Roman values to their own time. Much of this, again, has to do with what's happening with trade. Influences from the East are coming west, to Venice, to Genoa. Trade on the Silk Routes, trade through Constantinople, and ideas and particularly literature that previously in the West had been lost after the Roman Empire fell and books are burned and library Alexandria is burned and people didn't know the names of the Greek poets. They didn't know the Latin poets. They didn't know the stories and mythologies of who people were. They had monuments around. They had these old buildings around, but they had no idea what these buildings were for. The Colosseum is used as a place to herd goats, for instance. The Pantheon in Rome is used as a garbage dump. They had no idea that these places had historical significance or were important places in the past. They just looked like old buildings. And often they would tear them down and reuse the stone. In the 14th century, because of literature that came moving from the East into the West, particularly into Italy, there became an awareness of an entire culture that existed before Christianity, that Greek and Roman culture. And people began to read that. People began to appreciate that. And they decided that what they really wanted to do was to revive that, to give it a rebirth. They saw it as their cultural inheritance. And they began to adapt those values, which are values that are anthropological. They look at the human being before they look at the theological, to themselves. And so the Renaissance promotes a sense that the human being is the center of meaning rather than a theocentric center. I guess that's redundant. I should say it's human-centered rather than God-centered. And these are the beginnings of the values that are broadly, very broadly, called humanism. So think of the Renaissance as a huge shift in the way people approached and began to think about what truth is, what meaning is, and what is valuable and important to know. Prior to the Renaissance, it really is only theology. Well, and power and the like, but intellectually, not so much. After the Renaissance, and continuing until today, the human being increasingly becomes the subject of our thought, of our concern, of whom to serve. And that's even true, that's true politically. In the medieval times, nations existed to serve God. Kings existed to serve God. People existed to serve God. In modern times, governments exist to serve their people. Now, the two aren't necessarily contradictory. Matter of fact, I think of myself as a Christian humanist. But there is tension. And there is certainly not universal agreement on that. But this is the shift of the Renaissance. Here's a quotation from the Wikipedia article that I've asked you to read, but I think it very helpfully sums up a number of things. In some ways, humanism was not a philosophy, but a method of learning. Like I said, again, the question is, where do you start your inquiry? In contrast to the medieval scholastic mode, which focused on resolving contradictions between authors, humanists would study ancient texts in the original and appraise them through a combination of reasoning and empirical evidence. Humanist education was based on the program of Studia Humanitas, the study of the five humanities. And they got these right out of Greek and Latin cultures. This is what one studied when one was in the academy or one was under, one was being taught in the ancient world. Poetry, grammar, history, moral philosophy, and rhetoric. With rhetoric, that is the art of persuasion, being the primary one. Although historians have sometimes struggled to define humanism precisely, most have settled on a middle-of-the-road definition. The movement to recover, interpret, and assimilate the language, literature, learning, and values of ancient Greece and Rome. Above all, humanists asserted the genius of man, the unique and extraordinary ability of the human mind. That's a good way to put it, I think. The Renaissance gave value to humanity, and particularly human intellectual thought, which the medieval period never perceived. The dignity, one of the values of the ancient world was the dignity or weight or worth of the human being. Now, for them, in the ancient world, that worth only really applied to the upper class. The lower classes did not have that worth, did not have what was called that dignitas. The Renaissance recovers that and begins in many, many ways throughout culture and throughout their writings and the like to apply that to Western civilization. In some ways, humanism was not a philosophy but a method of learning in... I see that I have copied that twice, so we won't have to read it again. It is that sort of intellectual revolution that paves the way for virtually everything else that's going to happen in Western civilization. And I know this is a world history course, and so we're not just talking about Western civilization. But it is the case that as history unfolds, the Western world, England, France, Germany, and then later the United States, the Western world sets the, for better or worse, sets the agenda for most of the rest of the world for the next 500 years. So, during the Renaissance, they began to examine the Greek and Roman plays and stories and philosophers and histories for inspiration, and often to repeat them. They also, particularly as Constantinople was threatened, there were many refugees who came from Constantinople, came to Italy in particular, and brought with them a Greek New Testament, as well as manuscripts of the New Testament in Latin, and of the Bible, actually in Latin and in Greek. These were unknown in many ways before that. They had Jerome's Vulgate, they had a Latin version, but they didn't have the Greek. And they began to study these with great intensities, and The coming of the Greek New Testament to Western Europe during the Renaissance is absolutely foundational to what later happens with the beginning of the Protestant Church, with Luther and Calvin, Tyndale, and the like. They studied the religious mythologies of the past. They incorporated much of and admired the great artistic abilities of the ancient world. And they produced political pamphlets and theological pamphlets throughout Europe to spread these ideas. So, what all happened in the Renaissance? Well, among other things, they introduced Latin and Greek literary text into common culture. It wasn't just a province of a few monks now in a monastery who could read, but reading begins to spread. And as I mentioned, the Greek New Testament comes to Europe. They encouraged the Renaissance leaders, encouraged the use of the common language, the language of the people. Prior to that, Latin is reserved for the church and is the official language of the thrones and the like. But now they begin to publish things and write things in the common languages, including beginnings of translating the Bible into languages that the people could understand. And maybe they couldn't all read it, but at least if they had somebody read it for them, if there was someone who could read it for them, they could listen to it in their own language. Otherwise, it was completely foreign to them. It was listening to someone read a text in a language you didn't understand, and yet you said that was holy, and no wonder they didn't understand much about the Bible or the Christian faith. They increased dramatically the level of education throughout Europe, and many of these Renaissance leaders and early humanists become the primary teachers particularly in England, but in the universities throughout Europe. Erasmus is a name that you should be acquainted with. Erasmus was a Dutch scholar, early 16th century. Among other things, he did teach at Cambridge, but then ended up back on the continent later in life. He collected various biblical manuscripts that he found, and began to realize that there isn't just one single Bible manuscript. There are hundreds that he could find, or he didn't have any complete ones, and so he had various versions, and he merged those all together and created a basic text that was a translation of the Vulgate, that is the standard Catholic Bible, and published that on one side in Latin, and on the other side published the first Greek text that comes out in Europe. And in many respects, that becomes the basis about 100 years later for the King James Bible, the textual, the manuscript tradition that Erasmus led. And of course, the 15th century saw in Germany with Gutenberg the invention of not the printing press. That really isn't the case, because the printing press was well known in China hundreds and hundreds of years before this. But Gutenberg's invention, his innovation, was to invent movable metal type. So his typeface lasted way longer and made much better impressions than the old woodblock type. And this makes mass printing possible. Once his printing press is built and begins to turn out various volumes, and the Bible is the first volume that he prints, people copy his printing press, and it begins to grow all over Europe. So that within 100 years, there are now millions of printed pages, where previously it was hand-copied or made with movable wooden block type. And this changes the intellectual life of Europe in foundational ways. Many, many more people begin to learn to read, for instance. Things are read in their printed in their own language, and so if they can't read, they can have someone read to them and they can understand it. They are influenced by these pamphlets that are circulated in significant ways. And the pamphlets are the primary ways in which the various movements throughout this period of time spread. Florence is the city of Florence in Italy, which was an independent city, is often considered the birthplace of the Renaissance. And that's not really quite true. There were others who came before who got this ball rolling. Again, the Renaissance didn't start in any particular day. It's a movement that grows incrementally over time. But Florence is often understood as the hotbed or the center of where the Renaissance happened in the 13th century. And if you go to Florence today, you will see that they celebrate some of the leaders of the Renaissance. Here is a statue of Machiavelli. Machiavelli is a political leader, and he writes a book called The Prince, in which he describes what politics ought to be like when reason is the primary way that one approaches it. And what he basically comes down to is politics is ruthless. It's about power, and it's about gaining power, and really any way that you can gain power is legitimate. Even today, if you say that a certain politician is Machiavellian, what you mean is that he will do anything or she will do anything in order to assert or gain more power. And while we might think, well, that's disreputable, that's immoral, that's wrong, that's not ethical, many people appreciated Machiavelli greatly and still do, and believe that indeed he got it right. He makes the case that it's entirely ethical to be ruthless and devious, very significant politically. Leonardo da Vinci is well known as an artist, but he's also a scientist. He's an inventor. The Mona Lisa, of course, is probably his most famous painting, but actually the Lord's Supper painting is equally as well known. He exemplified the Renaissance principle of that he wanted to have reason over mysticism. And this contributed greatly to his, particularly his scientific endeavors. He looks at the human being not as a mystical creation, but rather as a series of systems that one could analyze and understand. He tries, for instance, to trace the circulatory system. Donatello is artist in his own right, but also probably more significantly the architect of much of the monumental buildings. The cathedral, for instance, in Florence is one of the things he worked on, as well as St. Peter's Basilica, which is built in this period of time. This is a statue of Amerigo Vespucci, who may not be nearly as well known as Da Vinci or Michelangelo or some of the others, but actually he's a map maker and an explorer in his own right. And Vespucci, what he did was he demonstrated, Columbus had sailed 1492, bumped into this other landmass, thought he was in India, called the people Indians, thought if he was right on the verge of finding China, came back and reported that to Isabella and Ferdinand. But it really was a little later voyage that Vespucci said, no, this is not India, this is not China, this is an entirely new landmass. It's got a huge northern area and a huge southern area. We didn't know it existed before, and so he began to draw maps of it. And these continents that he discovered actually gained their name from him. So America North and South America are named for the species. I thought that was worth putting in. This is Hercules and Cacus, one of the stories where Hercules conquers another strong guy. The Renaissance scholars loved, and sculptors loved the Roman and Greek themes, and they kept repeating them. They loved the realism, and they exalted in human dignity, and so they made their figures more and more and more realistic. And if one wanders around them today, it's not hard to imagine them coming to life right before your eyes. This sculpture was actually in Florence on one side of, I think, the city gates when you came in. And Michelangelo's David was on the other side of the gate. So you pass through these two sculptures that are so incredibly lifelike and so incredibly beautiful, truly amazing to see them in Florence. So Michelangelo is well known, and of course probably as well known for his work in the Vatican on the Sistine Chapel, and that famous centerpiece where the hand of God is coming down and touching Adam. And it is intended to demonstrate the divine giving the gift of dignity, of worth, of value to the humankind, among other interpretations. Great building projects went on during the Renaissance. Europe was becoming tremendously wealthy from a number of reasons, not the least of which was the gold and silver they were taking out of Mexico and later Peru, bringing it back to Europe, and funding many, many building projects, as well as a lot of wars and armies. But the church in Florence, the cathedral, is built during this period of time, during the Renaissance, and this is a fresco above it. I've always been impressed. The center figure there is a woman who has a banner across her lap that says Charitas, or charity, the notion of mercy. So, of course, a Christian value. We ought not have the sense that the Renaissance scholars or people or intellectuals were against the church. They weren't particularly they were acceptable church people given their age, acceptable Christians. But they didn't argue for the most part against the church or see the church as inadequate. They just were refocusing the church's efforts away from a strictly theological, theocentric point of view to that anthropomorphic or human point of view and starting place. This is a period of time that St. Peter's Basilica goes through a major remodeling. It had already existed, but was in great disrepair. And around 1506, under Pope Julius II, who is one of the Borgia popes, I believe, in the House of Borgia, decides that it's going to have a major remodeling and addition. There were plans drawn up ahead of time by other popes, and so he didn't start it, but he really put the wheels under it. And it's designed principally by Donato Bramati, by Michelangelo, Carlo Mandero, and Gio Lorenzo Bernini. They are the major architects. Michelangelo and Bernini in particular are remembered for bringing it to fruition, although it really was worked on for hundreds of years. St. Peter's is the most renowned work of the Renaissance architecture and the largest church in the world. One sees it whenever one watches the Pope, for instance, do a Mass, for instance, on Easter, the St. Peter's Basilica there in Rome, right next to the Vatican. It was quite intentionally built to be ornamental, monumental, to emphasize the glory and power of the Church there in the beginning of the 16th century. The problem is, how do you pay for it? How does the Church, which is losing significant ground in a lot of places, particularly in England, England has gone through a couple of different phases in which church property has been confiscated. We talked earlier about the Black Death. Many times the monasteries and the like, which earned income for the church, monasteries closed because so many monks had died, and these monasteries had not been, they were sometimes sold to other landowners, sometimes taken over by the English crown. The church had lost significant revenue from England. Kind of less true in the continent, but certainly from England. And while money is pouring into Spain and Portugal, in particular because of their provinces in the New World, particularly into Spain, not all of that is yet gone to the church. And so the question becomes, how do you pay for this major building project? Always a question with building projects, right? How do they get paid for? Well, a foundational way, a primary way that it was paid for was the decision to increase dramatically the sale of indulgences. Now, there were indulgences in the church tradition that, for hundreds of years prior to this. They didn't invent indulgences at this time, but they really increased their sales and actually even sent out salespeople in order to bring in revenue to help pay for St. Peter's. So an indulgence is one aspect or one part of the penance that one was expected to do for sins. If you did the correct penance often paid for the indulgence with some money, you got a certificate of indulgence that would free you in part or in whole from the temporal punishments that a person might deserve. So in other words, if you, upon sinning, one can expect bad things to happen to you, and that these things were going to be punishments from God. And even if they don't come in this life, they're going to come in purgatory, that sort of intermediate state where your soul is purified and you make penance and the like for your sins. And depending on how sinful you are, is depending on how long you have to spend there. Well, if you could buy an indulgence and go through the act of penance, you could lessen these temporal punishments and lessen the time and lessen the pain of purgatory. It's not accurate, and Protestants should be clear about this, it's not accurate to say that indulgences were about selling the forgiveness of sins, but they were about selling relief from punishments in this world and in purgatory for sins that we commit in this world. They are intended to demonstrate the sincerity of one's repentance. And like I said, the Vatican, the Pope, sent out representatives, the most famous of whom is a man named Tetzel, who goes to central Germany, central eastern Germany, and later actually he's brought on trial for violating church doctrine in what he said about the indulgences, because he was promising people that all they had to do was pay, and if they just paid, then right away they could buy an indulgence for someone else, maybe their mother or their father or their brother who had died and was in purgatory, they were certain. And if they would just pay some money, that person would be freed from purgatory. The Catholic Church actually never taught that, did not teach that you could buy someone out of purgatory that way. But Tetzel apparently did. He made the church tons of money doing this. It is really this abuse of forgiveness, this abuse of doctrine, of teaching, of the way the gospel is a free offer of salvation, understanding that God's forgiveness includes, it does not mean there are no consequences for sin, but those consequences are not the same as punishments. It's this abuse that really fires up Martin Luther. He has some doctrinal questions ahead already in 1517 and 1516, and prior to that, he has some qualms and the like about the church. He's not real sure of the Pope's authority in a number of ways. He's not real sure about a lot of things. But it is Tetzel in Germany talking about indulgences, selling indulgences in this way, that really lights the fire under him to begin those the protests that he leads. And he thinks his desire deeply is merely to lead a reform of the church. But once his teaching becomes known and his opposition to the church known, it is not a reform. The Reformation is really closer to a revolution than it is a reformation, and changes the whole notion and trajectory of Western Europe. Well, that's going to conclude and this third section. There are numerous things that we didn't talk about. It's been difficult to choose which ones to talk about and which ones to skip. These are the things that we have covered in this third section in brief, just a little review. We talked about these themes. We talked about international trade as being really one of the heartbeats of this time period. The Silk Routes, the Sea Routes, the Viking trade routes, the Inca and Aztec routes and roads that they used. Trade links the world together in ways that it previously had not been linked. We talked about the conquests or hostile takeovers. In specific, we looked at the Norman invasion of England, the Turkish invasion from Central Asia to the Mediterranean, the Aztec takeover in Mesoamerica, and the Inca takeover in Peru, as well as the Mongolian invasion that took over virtually everywhere except for the far reaches of Western Europe. We talked about the clash of religions, Buddhism, both within itself, different Southern and Northern Buddhism, as well as Buddhism's clash with Confucianism, particularly there in China. We talked about Islam, and mostly about Islam's clash with Christianity, that is the Crusades, as well as the Reconquista in Spain. And we also talked about internal divisions within Christianity during this period of time. And lastly, in this third section, we talked about sort of the political, social organization and life, the rise of national identity, so that by the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, the next big chunk of time, there is real identity. Not everywhere, of course, but it means something to say, I'm French. It means something to say, I'm an Englishman. It means something to say, I'm Spanish. And not just, well, I live in this English town, and therefore, you know, I'm a Dorchester, or I'm from Anjou in France. There's a national identity that arises during this period of time. We talked about the three Chinese dynasties that were in this time, the Song, the Yong, and the Ming, and how they dealt with their population. We talked about the importance of the Black Death, how that changed the whole history of the world and stretched from the Pacific to the Atlantic. Talked some about the church, and finally we've ended it with some reflections on the Renaissance. So these are the topics that we did get to cover, and my apologies for all of those hundreds and thousands of things that we did not get to. So this concludes Christian Leaders Institute History 101. I want to thank you for your time and for your energy, and hope you do well on the tests. I hope they're not too difficult. I look forward to World History 102, which is going to pick up right where we left off here, from 1500 until more recent times. It's always hard to know how far history should come forward. But for sure, things that we'll talk about in 102 are the Age of Exploration. And while that did start prior to 1500, it was just too big a topic to try to include in this course. We'll get more into the Reformation, that religious revolution that changed England, France, Germany, Switzerland, Scandinavia, all of Northern Europe, and really creates a very different culture from the other side of the Alps. We'll talk about the period of empire building that is colonialization, the times in which the Dutch, the Spanish, the French, the German, the English, and later the Italians begin to really dominate the world in at least politically and economically, and in many ways culturally. The Enlightenment is certainly a significant time. It is, in my opinion, phase two, basically, of the Renaissance, where the Renaissance moves from the theocentric to the anthropocentric view. I think the Enlightenment takes it one step farther and pretty well excludes a theocentric point of view. That's the change that happens in fundamental ways. We'll talk about the search for independence. This is the time of revolutions. The American, the French, revolutions throughout South America, as well as many, many changes in China, and then the search for independence, of course, leads us into basically the breakdown of the colonial empires, India becoming free and after the war. We'll talk about the industrial technical revolutions, certainly the coming of anything that we talk about in terms of mass technology today finds its roots during this period of time. The world is at war in significant ways. And finally, I think we'll talk about a search for a lasting peace. At least those are some of the areas that I'm exploring right now as I think about this History 102, and I look forward to going there very soon. In the meantime, God bless, and I pray that this course has been useful to you, and that you have indeed found it a blessing. Thank you.